call council back into session. I'm going to turn it over to Chairman Alexander, who's going to turn it over to Dr. Conahan, who's going to walk us through the decision document and start the motion process. Again, just as a reminder, as I said, now during the motion process, you can advocate, both council members, obviously, and the public, but advocate as to the motion that is pending at the time. Wide-ranging comments on why this is good or bad is not going to be helpful to the debate. We want you to focus on discussing what is pending in front of the council at the time. So with that, I'm turning it over to Chairman Alexander.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'll turn it over to Jamie to walk us through the decision document to see how we're going to flow today. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. If you go ahead and scroll to the next page, and maybe a little smaller. Thank you. So the plan today is to walk through these seven items, selecting your preferred alternatives in section 4.1 through section 4.6. Those are items number 1 through 6. And then last, we'll be looking for a motion to submit the amendment to NOAA Fisheries. Quickly, I will walk through an example of how the decision document is laid out, and I'll start with the next page, please. In each action item, and that corresponds to the same action items 1 through 6 listed on that page 2, they follow along in the order of the document in the alternative section. There's a table that describes in abbreviated text the options presented and the alternatives presented for the council to consider. And in the right three columns, you'll see the council's preliminary preferred, if there was one. The preferred by the advisory panel is also noted. Scrolling down just a little bit more into the next page. Under each table that summarizes the options, there's some just a little bit more down, please. There's a section on decisions, questions, and information to consider. I want to note that we did correct a mistake that's highlighted here. This is the actual text that should be displayed. So in here, you'll see some additional information we think is relevant for you to think through, including any key motions that may have had a little bit more context. We refer to certain affected environment sections and also some notes. At the very bottom of the table is an other important considerations or EIS reference. And so we tell you which section you can find the relevant impacts analysis within the document. So these all refer to the master draft amendment document for your discussion purposes. I won't skip ahead to the back, but I will say there is a summary of all the impacts analysis included. If you want the more abbreviated version of the summary, you'll see that in tabular form towards the back of the document. So our plan is to start at the beginning, work through actions 1 through 6, and I'll turn it back over to you, Mr. Chair, to discuss what the council's preference is.
Okay, so Chairman Alexander, it's my understanding there's no committee motion for preferred alternative in the first section.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so I will entertain motions as to the first section here, and please raise your hand and I'll call on you. So at least on my screen, there is no motions that have been offered that will address the target coverage level in the first section.
So question, how do we handle this situation, Mr. Chair?
Got an answer. Dr. McKenzie raised his hand. So Dr. McKenzie, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I sent this motion to Joan earlier. Move that the council adopt alternative section 4.1.1.2.4, option 2, suboption 2D, 100% coverage as the preferred alternative for Amendment 23. This coverage will be required for the first four fishing years following the effective date of Amendment 23 to establish a baseline of accurate and precise catch information for the fishery, and thereafter until a subsequent amendment modifies coverage levels. This coverage level selected is a target coverage rate, understanding that waivers may be needed to grant to be granted in limited circumstances and for good causes, for good cause only. Funding for this coverage will be provided at the following rates of industry funding. Year one, 100% coverage of all trips, industry funding for EM, both equipment and review costs at 0% and ASM at 0%. Year two, 100% coverage of all trips, industry funding for EM, equipment and review costs at 0% and ASM at 0%. Year three, 100% coverage of all trips, industry funding at, industry funding at the, that's for EM, review costs at 0%, ASM at 25%. Year four, 100% coverage of all trips, industry funding EM, review costs at 0%, ASM at 50%. Year four funding will serve as default coverage and funding until a new amendment is completed and implemented if necessary. Year five, adjusted coverage levels and follow-on action or default coverage rates. And if I can get a second, I can provide a rationale.
Seconded by Mr. Olszewski.
Thank you. The Northeast multi-species fishery suffers from a lack of accountability due to low observer coverage, averaging approximately 20% since Amendment 16 was implemented. This strategy maximizes available agency funding as well as any other funding sources that become available, for example, through states and the NGOs, to establish a baseline of information about the catch, landings, and discards in the Northeast multi-species fishery. It is also a recognition that anything much less than 100% coverage creates an incentive to illegally discard fish to the detriment of long-term stability in the fishery. The funding changes in years three and four create an incentive for fishermen to adopt EM to monitor the fishery while preserving a choice for vessels to continue with ASM if they choose. Default measures ensure that council inaction will not sacrifice the gains from the first 4 years of such a significant investment in establishing new baselines for monitoring.
All right. As our procedures normally do, we're going to go out to the audience first for comment. Before we do that, in light of the discussion of lawsuits on both sides, I'm going to call on Attorney McDonald to maybe just give us some advice on whether this framework or this motion would satisfy the Magnuson-Stevens Act requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In reviewing this motion, I've noted a couple of items of concern that I think the council should keep in mind for this motion and any following motions, if there are any, on coverage levels. And my primary concern is what occurred with Amendment 5 to the herring plan. And for those who don't remember that plan, there was a proposal that came to the agency that was disapproved that had 100% coverage and a fixed dollar amount for the industry to pay. It was a $325 per day at sea cost. In going through Department of Commerce review and our review, it was determined that setting a specific amount for the industry to pay that does not cover the entire industry cost and requires agency to fund the remaining costs is a cost share vision that would conflict with the Anti-Deficiency Act. The other concerns that are potentially here, and this seems to do that on sort of the surface review here, because it sets industry funding costs at 0%. There's no other mechanism apparent that outside of the government for funding the industry's costs. This leaves open the question of what would happen if the government didn't have funding to fund the industry's costs. What kind of coverage would there be, and what would that do to the fishery? And it sort of leads to this, one of the second concerns of Amendment 5 was this policy concern, and combined with the Anti-Deficiency Act concern of sort of binding the agency to appropriations that the agency doesn't have. And the potential third concern, and this is something that just as a note of caution, that with these sort of incremental approaches, if there are going to be, if there's going to be an idea that the government will reimburse the agents, government will reimburse the industry for its costs, that is always subject to government having, at least to date, the mechanism for that has been a government grant that has funded the reimbursement. To date, that has been approved by the DOC GC, but that always is subject to that approval. So that is another caveat that I need to raise this point.
All right, thank you very much. I also see Mr. Pentney's hand that is up. I'm going to call on him. He can contribute something to this before we go out to the audience with those caveats in the motion. Mr. Pentney.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. This is really what I have are a couple of questions for the maker of the motion, trying to understand the intent here. And I hope that those questions, if we can, if we understand the motion better, will be relevant for people, you know, that may be commenting on support for or against the motion. So first and foremost, I'm trying to understand the distinction between the coverage target of 100% in years 1 through 4 and the notion that industry funding would be either 0%, so no burden on the industry, or scaling up to potentially 25 or 50% of the ADC monitoring C-day costs on industry. And I'm trying to understand how those two different variables, if you will, work together or play off one another. In other words, is the concept that we would have coverage, say in years 1 and 2, up to 100% as long as the industry bears no burden. So if the amount of funding to reimburse industry was sufficient to cover 50% of the trips, then that 100% would drop to 50. If we had enough funding to cover 100% of trips, we would, but we would scale the coverage rate subject to putting no burden, no cost burden on the industry. Or is it the flip, which is the coverage target is 100%, and we will hopefully impose no burden on the industry and reimburse them 100% of their costs. But if the funding is insufficient to do so, the 100% coverage would remain the same, and the amount of industry contribution, if you will, would scale up from zero to something higher, depending on the amount of funding that we have. I think that's a really important distinction to understand how these two play together. And it also bears on the point that Mitch raised regarding the Anti-Deficiency Act and the issues that we found with Herring Amendment 5. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to turn it back to the maker of the motion, Dr. McKenzie, to see if he can address some of those issues that were raised.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, to your question, the first scenario, I think, is what is my intention behind this, that we try to get as much coverage, as long as federal funds are available, we have 100% coverage of all trips with no imposition upon, no cost burden upon industry itself. I think the second alternative is less desirable because my goal in this is to get 100% coverage or something close to that, or as close to that as possible, without putting any burdens upon industry for at least as much time as there are federal funds available for that. And so I think the other important thing that I might want to qualify this is that by making these target rates, those targets are subject to the availability of federal funds. I apologize for not including that language in there, and I'll happily put that language in there if it's acceptable to the seconder of the motion. But I also have a question, if that responds to those issues, Mr. Bennett, I also have a question that we've been talking about industry-funded monitoring alternatives in this action for years now. And I'm sure this question has been brought before the service in the past, either at the council level or in private discussions outside council meetings. Given that we have been discussing industry-funded and this joint industry-funded and government-funded monitoring alternatives, what has been the service's position up to now? Because it seems to me that if the Anti-Deficiency Act is a non-starter for this action, we should have been talking about this for quite some time. So that would be a question that I would have on this. But to your question itself, Mr. Pentney, the scenario you lay out in the first instance is what my goal. I would like to see 100% coverage of all trips for as long as federal funds are available with no burden upon industry.
Mr. Pentney, do you care to respond to that? Or
Sure. Yes, thank you. Okay, well, I guess I can respond to the specific question that Dr. McKenzie asked about, the status quo. Well, as I would describe the status quo, we set a target coverage rate, 40%, 35%, whatever it might be in a given year. And the industry bears the responsibility for covering the full cost of the C days, step one. And then step two is we've been very fortunate the last several years to receive supplemental appropriations through appropriations bills that have allowed us to reimburse sectors for up to 100% of those C day costs. But under the current structure, if those funds dried up, if you will, or were exhausted, then the industry would remain responsible for bearing the costs of their C days through their service provider contracts that they have to achieve the target coverage rates. So the one thing that I think is missing from this motion, as I'm understanding it, is what is that base coverage that we would impose or strive for, absent any available supplemental appropriations. As an example, playing this motion out, let's assume that in year one, we had sufficient funds to fully reimburse sectors for all costs, even at 100%. Year two, same. But at the end of year two, we ran out of those supplemental appropriations that we have. Year three sets 100% target coverage rate for all trips, but industry for EM is 0% and ASM is 25%. Well, if we have no funds available to reimburse sectors, what's the coverage rate? Is it zero? Is it 25%? I'm just really unclear. And I think I want to understand this motion so that people can comment on it and we can have a really robust discussion around this motion. I think it's a very interesting idea that addresses a lot of the concerns, but I think, as is with many of these, the devil's is in the details, and understanding what would happen under various funding scenarios is important. So thank you.
So I think with that, I see a bunch of hands up and following the procedure that we've followed for the longest times I've been the chairman. We have a motion that seconded some clarification of questions. We got some legal advice with some caveats for us to be concerned. So I'm going to go out to the audience first and then back to the council. And it's going to be Gigaloni, Odell, Raymond. This is the number. Rogan, Lorenc, and Gaethel. That's what I got right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How's the audio?
Fine. It's fine. Yep.
Great. Vito Gigaloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. I just want to say this is going to come as a surprise, but the direction of this actually finally addresses the key concern that we've tried to put forward. Let me say categorically that the DEIS seemed to be very unilateral. It unilaterally defined benefits that we don't recognize. We did not see anything in the DEIS that justifies or correlates to the alternatives, with the industry funding being the context. This motion hopefully addresses the key concern that industry has, which is what Mr. Patney just articulated, was that right now we have 100% responsibility. And you don't need to have, I saw the PDT memo that came out yesterday or this morning that talks about you can't really determine what the net revenue is, but you don't really need to have a peer review to know that the cost of the at-sea monitoring program, which is the only thing we have ready for prime time right now, is that cannot be afforded by the majority of the vessels in the fleet at 100%. So if we run out of money in 2 years, we've bankrupted the fishery. I can't see that as responsible. This motion actually addresses the most serious concern. We don't have benefits. We don't believe in what's been done in the DEIS. But everyone knows you got the money to go 100%. So it's the industry funding. And this also contemplates a future action, which we also believe is going to be important. You do not have a way right now. You don't have a structure in place that allows an equitable distribution of monitoring costs. You can't even meet the guiding principles of a new IFM program that have been put out there, which is to consider the ex-vessel revenue of the fishery and the diversity of the fishery and fisheries that are in stress. We're all of the above. I think the incentives of the idea or the structure of this are heading in the right direction. I never thought I would support something like that, but I think that this is at least addressing the industry cost issue, and it puts a timeline or a time limit on us actually doing a good job, which I don't feel we've done a good job, and I'll say we have not done a good job in Amendment 23 of addressing the realities of this. This motion could right-size it. This motion should cover the law, because we know we have enough money to do this. And if you believe in your DEIS, you got blended costs for EM, so you could pretty easily come up with a budget that's gonna cover us through this period while we do a good job of coming up with a structure that equitably does this. The sector system is not set up to handle 100% monitoring on an insolvent fishery. It would be reckless to go down that road. So that's my, I know you probably got to refine this, but the idea of this is favorable because of the acknowledgement, finally, of industry's inability to pay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Gigaloni. Ms. Odell.
I'd like to remind the public, please do not lower your hand until after you've spoken.
Okay. Oh, thanks, Tom. Jackie Odell, Northeast Seafood Coalition. So, Mr. Chairman, can I ask, we had a discussion yesterday under updates that was provided by John Hare on the available, Dr. Hare on the available funding. That's what's been spent and what's left available for the groundfish program for monitoring. And I kind of thought that that was going to be a discussion that we were going to have before we started bringing up these motions. I'm curious, and I'm actually hopeful that when we go back to the council for a discussion on this motion, we're going to have a conversation about that, because, you know, it's really, really critical for any of these discussions to recognize the difference between what industry can afford, the affordability factor, and, you know, in relation to meeting our requirements of the Magnuson-Stevens Act as well. And then, you know, doing something more than that because money's available in the short term. I'm hoping that we're going to have a more clear understanding of that if there's going to be a discussion about basing any, you know, decision making on federal funding. Thank you.
Sure. And I'm happy to make a comment on that. I think yesterday during the reports, I had said we hope to have a discussion today, but if you had any questions yesterday, a general question, that would have been the time, and nobody did. And then just now when the presentation was made, I think there was several questions directed at Mr. Pentney during the Q&A period, and I didn't see any on this topic from the audience. And now we have a motion pending. I really don't want to unwind the rules we put in place to start asking questions from the public kind of out of turn. So I think I would encourage council members, when we come back to the council, if they want to inquire of that, but I'm trying to, you know, be consistent in my rulings on this. And I think there were a couple of opportunities to ask him that question. And I hope a council member will ask him when we come back to the table. Anything else, Ms. O'Dell? Okay, next up, Ms. Raymond.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to this motion. I too would like to express appreciation to the makers of the motion for their recognition of the fact that the industry cannot afford to pay the kind of monitoring coverage levels that are proposed in this motion and have been discussed throughout the amendment development process. It's hard for me to completely say whether the Associated Fisheries of Maine would support this motion or not without first the makers answering the questions that were asked by Mr. Pentney, and without an understanding of how much federal funding is remaining to cover industry costs, and whether or not that amount that's remaining could actually achieve the coverage levels that are described in this motion. The Associated Fisheries of Maine and the Northeast Seafood Coalition wrote a letter to Dr. Hare several weeks ago asking several questions about funding levels, and we have not yet received a response to our letter. It's important to point out that my understanding is, at least, that of the $30 million that is made available, the majority of it has been spent by the agency on their own costs. There's only been $2 million spent on the sea days for the sectors, and yet somehow there seems to be only $12 million left, according to Director Neese's memo, to cover. We need more information about what funding is still available, and answers to Mr. Pentney's questions about the logistics of how this actually works. Is 100% a target, or is it fixed? If it's fixed and we don't achieve it, does that mean the fishery doesn't operate? So hopefully the makers can answer Mr. Pentany's questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Mr. Brogan.
There we go. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. We appreciate the motion that was put forward and the rationale behind it. This will maximize the available money that remains from congressional appropriations. It creates a clear incentive to transition to EM, which is should be part of this fishery going forward, and is a strong roadmap with a clear default that will tell us what will happen if and when the council goes through a review process in the future. To the regional administrator's question about what drives this process, we feel strongly that the needs of the fishery, what's necessary to administer this fishery, provide and ensure accountability for all catch and respect annual catch limits and ACEs needs to be driving this process, not available funding. This fishery shouldn't be at the mercy of congressional funding, and it shouldn't be able to be starved because of unavailable funding. This fishery needs what it needs. It's been often described as a Cadillac of a fishery management program, and it needs the information to work correctly. To put a caveat in there that will make it this necessary element of the fishery go away in years that congressional funding is not available will put us on a course for possible failure in the future. So with that, I suggest that this motion, if it's going to be amended to respond to the regional administrator's question, that it be amended that notes that in the industry responsibility will be subject to appropriations and other funding sources, that will be the what moves, not the coverage level. This fishery, all of the analysis in the EIS shows that this fishery needs high levels of observer coverage, high levels of monitoring, and it shouldn't be gutted because of funding issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I see Dr. Cornan's hand up. I don't know if she wanted to add something or had left her hand up. Dr. Cornan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick comments. In the line that discusses year four, it says funding will serve as a default coverage and funding until a new amendment is completed and implemented if necessary. I think it would potentially be a framework. So I would not, my understanding is we wouldn't have to initiate a whole new amendment if this went through. And second, I just want to refer council members to section 4.4. Certainly you can discuss it a little bit later, but this section talks about different mechanisms available, some of which Dr. McKenzie pointed out in the preamble to this motion.
Okay, thank you for that. The lineup now is Ms. Lorenk, Mr. Gayfield, and Mr. Smith. Ms. Lorenk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Allison Lawrence with Conservation Law Foundation. CLF supports this motion. It will achieve the goals and objectives of the amendment to improve catch accounting, determine total catch and effort, and to minimize bias to the extent possible without burdening the fishing industry with immediate costs, which is consistent with the council's intent for the amendment. Selecting electronic monitoring can also help further offset costs by half for some vessels. And the remaining congressional funds can and should be put towards a robust monitoring program that collects accurate, precise, and timely data. This motion does just that. I'm a broken record on this point, but the agency has made it very clear that the data collected through the monitoring program is the primary method for tracking annual catch limits to ensure accountability and prevent overfishing in compliance with MSA. According to the DEIS, 100% monitoring performs better than any other coverage in reducing bias and improving accuracy, compliance, and enforcement. Thus, 100% monitoring in this motion will provide the agency with the best data possible to help ensure statutory requirements are met. Beyond the benefits related to improved management performance, we've heard from fishermen on the West Coast that 100% monitoring leveled the playing field, built trust, and led to better use of quota. To address the concerns raised by the regional administrator, we support the statement by Mr. Brogan that coverage should be the driver here and agree with his suggested amendment. Ultimately, the current monitoring program is inadequate for management, and this motion reaches the middle ground that the chairman referenced in his opening remarks. We urge the council to pass the motion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, Mr. Gaethel, then Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Gaethel, Fish and Vessel, Ellen Diane. I think however people vote on this motion, there are several issues they need to address on the record for the motion. Specifically the biological costs of this motion. How much mortality is acceptable? How many hundreds of thousands of pounds of egg-bearing lobsters, oversized lobsters, wolffish, pout, thorny skates, things that are released alive on unobserved trips are acceptable mortality in to worship this false god of accuracy. You know, I took an oath as a council member to conserve and manage living marine resources, not to conserve and manage dead marine resources. And that's what this is creating. For those of you who don't know, because you don't fish, on an observed trip, virtually everything that's brought on board dies. On an unobserved trip, most of it is that you can't keep is released alive before we're even finished setting the net out again. So you have to address this on the record because it's going to be very, very important. Second, who pays to me is somewhat relevant because the crew is going to quit. No crew will work with 100% monitoring. They can't stand it. It's very, very burdensome. And so the fishery will collapse in a heartbeat. And the only viable alternative will be the common pool, which has no monitoring and a very high discard rate. So everything that the makers of this motion claim they're trying to do, it's going to work in the exact opposite. So again, I think there are a lot of things that need to be addressed by the makers of this motion, but by council members as individuals on the record about, you know, why having 100% monitoring is more important than conserving and managing living marine resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jeff Smith.
Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, we can.
All right. Thank you, Jeff Smith with the Nature Conservancy in Maine. Thanks for the opportunity. We certainly appreciate the spirit of this motion and what it's trying to achieve. I believe that all of the focus that we've had on cost and industry's ability to pay has really overshadowed the purpose and need for this amendment, which is to improve the reliability and accountability of catch reporting to ensure that there's an accurate and precise representation of catch. I want to take this time to just say that I believe that Amendment 23 is really a referendum on the council's commitment to the sector management program it started 10 years ago. I think you all know that the council moved away from input controls back then in favor of sectors and hard quotas because the input controls like days at sea and trip limits and differential counting were not working for the fish or the fishermen. And this was a wholesale change that we approved of at the time. But the problem is that the council has not adopted a monitoring program to accompany that new management approach. We built a monitoring program that assumes you can monitor a relatively small portion of the catch and apply those rates to unobserved trips to get a good picture of what's going on in the water. And I think all the analysis by the PDT and the peer review have demonstrated that assumption is flawed, and therefore the monitoring program is. And I don't think we need the PDT analysis to see that the sector management system has created intense economic pressures on fishermen to illegally discard fish that they don't have quota for and they can't afford to lease. It's just common sense. And the council has created a management system where a fisherman's rational economic decision is to do something they hate to do, and that's to throw away perfectly good fish. And I don't believe that all fishermen are doing that, but I think that the problem with this current monitoring program is it is rewarding those fishermen who are, and it's penalizing the fishermen who are following the rules at their own economic peril. I think that's wrong, and I think the council has an obligation to fix it in this amendment. So, you know, it was just mentioned that, people feel like if we comprehensively monitor this fishery, that people are going to go into the common pool, and I get that. But I also think that if the council fails to approve comprehensive monitoring today that provides accurate, precise, and timely data to managers and assessment scientists, then it should initiate a new groundfish action that does away with sector management and output controls and goes back to days at sea. Output management without comprehensive, cost-effective monitoring is a recipe for disaster in a multi-species fishery like the groundfish. And so I think the real decision today before the council is whether it wants to continue to improve sector management or move to back to days at sea and input controls. And I hope you do the former and adopt a motion or something similar to this to comprehensively monitor this fishery. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Next up, Eben Newkirk, and then Dr. Peter Oster.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I would have to agree with everything that Jeff Smith had to say, is that I'm a small boat fisherman, and I actually moved into doing the 100% program, and I have no regrets of doing it, and I feel like it's a really good thing, and I hadn't changed my fishing styles, just the timing of the years that I go fishing, and I have no problem. I did the last two or three trips of that, any discards that I had, it really wasn't that bad, and I had no problems with trying to learn a new system to try to make the fishery a better fishery. Is that I think it's wrong to have any fish discarded, and I think that everyone, it's a real problem. It really is. It's really bothersome to the owner operators like me, is that you get hired out crews that do the wrong things and they discard huge amounts of fish and culling through fish, only landing the mediums and the larges. That's all wrong. That shouldn't be going on. You should keep what you catch. And if you're catching small stuff and you don't want to catch small stuff or keep it, you ought to be towing a bigger mesh. Change your fishing style a little. So I 100% agree with doing the 100% program, and I'm in it already. Thank you very much.
Great. Dr. Oster.
Hi, thank you. Just a quick comment about the mortality of bycatch, especially in relation to Dave Goffel's comment, and this is real quickly. I was an observer 35, 40 years ago in the Bering Sea and North Pacific, and there were a number of species that myself as an observer were encouraged to ensure that they go back in the water as much as possible alive. And it sounds like there's some additional interactions that might be useful with the folks running the NEFOP program to change the protocols to minimize that amount of mortality in the system.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Next up, Dana Hammond.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, thank you. I agree with, we are Fish and Vessel Nicole Lee. We are currently in the EM program, max retention. I agree with what Jeff Smith had to say on the coverage rates, and I find the camera system not to be invasive at all on crew or captain, and I support that 100%.
Thank you very much. That concludes the comments from the audience. I see no other hands from the audience, so I'm going to come back and call on Mr. Reed.
Thank you, Dr. Chairman. Appreciate it. So I have a question for Dr. Hare. Maybe it's already been discussed, but about the amount of funding that's actually available, but he can hold his answer until I get done, if you don't mind. So I want to somewhat disagree with Mr. Gingaloni. I don't see the industry being able to pay any part of it in the next 4 years. I mean, we're in a tough spot now, and I don't see that changing in the medium to short or even long term. And I'd like to point to the DIS and the public comment. There's a discussion about operating profit in that document, which shows numbers like 60%, 70% operating profit. That's totally misleading, because it only has deductions from gross revenue for fuel, ice, grub, and any ACE. It doesn't include interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, crew, mortgage, insurance, maintenance, and a lot of other things, which leads me to believe that any level of industry funding is unattainable at this point. So I'd like to make a motion to amend, and I'm sorry, Joan, I didn't send it to you, but I'm just working on it, a seat of my pants. So what I'd like to do is where it says year one, I would like to put a year one dash four. And I would like to strike the entire line for year two, strike the entire line for year three, and I would like to strike the line for year four up to the period after 50%. And if I get a second, I have some rationale, Mr. Chairman.
Seconded by Dr. McKenzie.
Okay, thank you. So the rationale behind this is maybe as convoluted as all of Amendment 23, but it's going to require additional action later on today. It is my opinion that, and I'm talking about the exemption west of Area 7130. The funding needed to cover 45% of the trips west of 7130 that land less than 2% of groundfish. And if you do the math, that's 55 pounds of groundfish per trip. That's it. And the discard rate is about 22 pounds. So that can be redirected to cover the additional years for others that land 98% of the groundfish. Little or no benefit of coverage west of 7130, and NEFOP would actually still be in place there. And actually, NEFOP could also serve as a base rate to Mr. Bentley's question. All these measures in my cost saving or cost redirection were recommended by the council. So I hope that you'll consider this, and that way the industry doesn't have to pay a penny for coverage. And in my opinion, that's what they need. Thank you.
So before I move on, I'd like to bring back up your question you asked Dr. Hare on the funding that's available, because obviously with the main motion as well as this proposed amendment, the money available is important. So maybe I'll ask Dr. Hare to walk through the funding as he sees it, that takes a snapshot as of today.
Hang on, John, I'm trying to find him.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Tom, for finding me down at the bottom of the list. We currently have about $12 million available for industry costs, and that includes funds from FY18, FY19, and FY20. And then, you know, obviously the FY21 budget is not complete. So I hope that answers your question, Mr. Reed.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Hare. It does answer my question. And I will point out that 45% of the trips that are taken west of 7130, I'm not exactly sure what that contribution to redirecting funds is, but it is substantial. And it'll put them where it's really needed. And I don't see any benefit to the nation of having that money wasted west of 7130. Thank you.
Okay, so a couple things here. I'm gonna go back to Attorney McDonald, and then I've got normally what we do, because this is obviously a substantial change, a motion to amend, we go back out to the audience, but I want to sit here with the council first, and I see, so I'm gonna call on Attorney McDonald maybe to comment on this, and then I've got Chairman Alexander, Chairman of the committee, and then Ms. Eitri. So, Attorney McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this motion, I think there was discussion earlier about adding something to Dr. McKenzie's original motion that subjected this funding to, oh, there it is there. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm catching up a little bit. So it is subject to available agency funding. The one, there is another question that Mr. Pantani asked that I think still needs to be addressed, and that is, what is the baseline of coverage that would occur, let's say in, you know, I don't know how long $12 million lasts. Maybe it lasts through year four and there's 100% coverage, but let's say it doesn't. And year four, there is, you know, only enough money for 25% coverage. How does this motion handle that scenario? And how does that potential scenario ensure cost accountability? So those are some questions that still occur the way that the motion is written on its face. Maybe there are amendments that can be made, or maybe there's discussion that can be, that can address some of these concerns. That's what occurs to me now, and I'll continue to read and see if anything more occurs to me.
Okay, I see Mr. Pentney's hand up as well. I'm gonna call him out of turn just for the same reason, trying to get some input on his concerns that he expressed in the original motion.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So I wasn't actually raising my hand to comment on that. I was gonna ask a question of the maker and seconder of the motion to suggest a clarification, unless it truly is their intent. In line four, well, the second sentence says that the coverage will be required for the first 4 years and thereafter until a subsequent amendment modifies coverage levels. And I was going to suggest that amendment be replaced with council action to provide the flexibility that if the change that would be desired could be done through a framework action, that option or opportunity remains rather than requiring a full-blown amendment. But again, I defer to the intent of the maker of the motion on that, but it was just a suggestion that I was wanted to make.
Mr. Reed?
Yeah, I appreciate Mr. Penney's comments, and I think Dr. Cornain addressed that a little bit as well, and I have no problem with his change. Apparently he's a doctor, you know, he's a doctor of English, not me.
Dr. McKenzie, any problem?
No, that's fine, and I would be fine if this amendment isn't voted up and we go back to the main motion. I would be fine with that in the underlying motion as well.
Okay, great. All right. So now I'm going to go back to I've got Chairman Alexander, who's the chairman of the committee. Then it's going to be Eatry, Ware, Sissonwine.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. So a couple questions or maybe comment questions. The default, the way Eric explained it, would be NEFOP in year five. Is that correct?
Well, NEFOP is default for sure, because that will still be in place. And if there's any additional funding beyond that, so be it. But in my opinion, the default rate would be the NEFOP rate.
Oh, okay. All right. That clarifies. I just wanted to make sure. And Mike had mentioned that in his comments, so I just wanted to clarify what, if that answered his question that he had asked of Matt originally on the original motion. And the way I read this, Maggie's comment on targets is already in the body of the motion. Am I right in that, Eric? That those are all targets, not hard numbers.
Yeah, and actually the underlying motion should say probably up to 100% coverage. So that way we're clear that it is a target of up to 100.
And I like your rationale on saving that money, because that would stretch that money out a little bit. I when I saw the original motion yesterday, I actually called a couple of the a person involved in the thing to find out, you know, where's the money coming from. Talked to her for a while. My take on the original motion was it was going to be roughly $24 to $25 million if we use $6 million a year as a number to fund that first bunch, and we only had 12 million. So, but if that would free up 46% of the funding to fund the rest of the stuff up north where 98% of the fish are caught, that would make sense. So, a question for Dr. Hare on the funding. Is it okay to ask him a question, John? I'm sorry.
Hey, you're the chairman. Go ahead.
Okay. So hey, Trey. That's my brother's dog, FYI. question for, and I left all my notes at home when I ran out, so I'm going by strictly by memory. I noticed that the onshore cost in 2020 were forecast to be $3 something million. And last year we spent $2 million on the industry. The offshore cost was $2 million. Can you explain why that's twice as, not quite twice, but almost twice as much, the onshore cost as what it actually costs to observe the boat?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there was a similar question in our response to the letter from, or the request from Tom Neese regarding shoreside costs. So, you know, we're reimbursing trips that occur, and our shoreside costs are based on the ASM groundfish target coverage level at the beginning of the year. And so many of these costs are expended through contracts, which we forward fund through the end of the fishing year. And then any anticipated costs that are not realized remain in those contracts and are used for future costs. So, it's sort of a simple answer is we're forward funding the shoreside costs based on the coverage rate. And then we're reimbursing the actual coverage after it happens on the industry side.
Okay, so then apparently there'll be money to roll over to the following year. So, okay, all right.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, again, you know, sort of in a sort of general sense, yes. But we have to make sure that we're following all the grants and contract law, which is part of how we are spending these funds. But in a general sense, yes.
Okay, and then just a general comment on the motion itself, and you know, the whole idea intrigued me when I saw it, like I said all along, you know, the industry needs to know at the end of this, they're not going to get stuck with 100% monitoring bill on this fishery at the end. There needs to be a backstop at the end, a cap of some sort. And I don't know what that, you know, I got some ideas on what that cap is, but I'll listen to the discussion around the table. So, all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me.
Just a couple of things before we continue. So just so nobody thinks I'm intentionally skipping them over, I want to make a little complaint about the GoToWebinar, because when a new person puts their hand up, they jump to the top of the list. So I'll just give you an example. Libby was number 2 on the list. Now she's number 5 on the list. So I'm trying to, on the side, keep track of that so nobody thinks I'm I'm jumping them, but that's one of my challenges here at this end. The second thing, we now have a motion to amend pending. I see a bunch of committee council members' hands up. What my usual process and our usual process is, if there's a substantial change to a motion through a motion to amend, we go out to the audience. So what I, first, and then back to the council. So those that have their hands up, if you've got a clarifying question about the motion to amend, we'll take that now. But if we're going to start advocating for it, I'd rather go out to the audience first and then come back. You'll have a full opportunity to discuss it. I'm just trying to follow the procedure that we laid down at the beginning. And those that are texting me at the same time that I'm talking, I'm trying to address one thing at a time. So with that, I'm going to call on Libby Eatree.
Thank you. I was seeing my name drop lower and lower, and I was getting kind of offended from that, John. No, thank you very much for calling me. I have a couple clarifying questions, and I think that they're applicable to both this motion and the underlying motion. They're slightly building off of some of the comments and questions that both Mitch and Mike have raised from the agency. You know, as a starting point, I want to say that I truly appreciate the intent and the focus that folks are trying to go with this. But I just want to make sure that I am understanding, for example, the current motion to amend. What I am understanding this to mean is that in years 1 through 4, we will have 100% coverage of all trips so long as there is federal funds and or state funds or whatever funds available to cover 100% coverage of all trips. And if there is not funding available, we would have a reduced rate based off of the funding that is available. And then in subsequent years, after year 4, the default coverage rate would go down to NFOP coverage levels, which we would then adjust based off of something in a subsequent framework in year 5 and onward. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So throughout all of your motion, the industry cost is the coverage. The coverage we have is based off of the funds available.
Yes.
Okay. I think that that's important for the discussion. I have some obvious comments, but that's just my clarifying question, and I'm not really sure how to do it with the underlying motion, but just pin it for whatever happens next. Thank you very much for letting me clarify.
Great. Thank you. Next up, Ms. Weah.
Thank you. Two questions. My first question is there a rationale for why 4 years is specified? I'm questioning if the funding will last that long, so I didn't know if there was a reason why it was 4 years as opposed to 3 years or 5 years.
Mr. Reed or Dr. McKenzie?
Yeah, I'm only amending the underlying motion, and that's where year 4 and 5 came from, so I'll defer to Dr. McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These years come from a recognition that, one, there's finite federal funds at the current time, right now, at this current moment, and we also need to establish, at the very minimum, we need to establish solid baselines, and the need for getting comprehensive monitoring on the water for a period of time that allow us to really take a hard look at what's been going on with our stock assessments and our data collection systems and our modeling requires at least 4 years or so of this, balanced off against the likelihood that the funds that we currently have might stretch that long. So that was my thinking behind having a 4-year window on that. And Mr. Chairman, if I may, when it's appropriate, cycle back to me. I have a question for the maker of the motion to amend.
Libby, you all set?
I actually have one more question.
Sure. Yeah, Megan, sorry.
That's okay. I am not understanding the sentence that starts year 4 funding will serve as a default coverage and funding. Am I understanding correctly, or someone can let me know if I'm not? Let's say there is zero funding in year 4. That means we would be at NFOP coverage levels in year 4, and that would continue on until there is another council action. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. It's going to be Sissonwine, Griffin, Gates, Balzano, McKenzie, and Niece. Dr. Sissonwine.
Yes, I'm still not clear that I read this text in the way Libby interpreted it and Eric Reed responded positively. I'm trying to understand what the phrase the necessary coverage to support administration of the fishery has primacy. Industry funding rates are subject to the availability of agency funds in congressional appropriations. And we're requiring 100% coverage, except for some circumstances, some unusual circumstances. So I read those things together as saying that the 100% coverage comes first. And if there isn't money, it's still going to be 100% coverage, even if the agency can't pay the costs, which is not the interpretation that I thought Libby was seeking, and got a positive affirmative response on it. Can someone clarify what the intent of the sentence is that says the coverage level to support administration of the fishery has primacy?
So I'm going to call on Dr. McKenzie as the maker of the motion, but I also, Attorney McDonald's hand is up, so maybe he could opine on that as well. Dr. McKenzie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My intention with that line was to address Mr. Pentney's concerns about about failing to meet Anti-Deficiency Act requirements. Basically, what I'm trying to show is that that we have coverage. These are target levels of coverage subject to industry funding, and that subject to federal funding, and when the funds are there, they are prioritized for supporting this aspect of the fishery and its management.
If I could just comment, I understand that. I suspect there are clearer ways of expressing that point, but I'll leave it at that for this comment. But I am concerned about that phraseology. It could be interpreted in many different ways. Thank you.
Attorney McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't necessarily have an explanation, except I have had similar questions along the way. I think it would be helpful at some point to have maybe a more definitive statement as to what is going on in the fourth, potentially in the fourth and fifth year. And the one other matter I think would be helpful to clarify is the set that I've seen so far. Anyway, the sentence that talks about limited, that waivers may be granted in limited circumstances and for good cause only, it would be helpful to describe what is intended by that. And I think that might also relate to the base level of coverage that may, if there is one here. It sounds like the base level of coverage is no coverage, is what I'm hearing potentially. I think I've heard that, for example, that if in year four there's no funding for industry costs, the industry would get NEFOP level coverage, and then that would serve as the rate moving forward, as the default rate, if you will. So I think it would be helpful for me to have a little bit more clarity about that, and then how that may work with waivers or not.
All right. Any Dr. McKenzie or Mr. Reed want to comment on that? If not, hearing none.
Dr. McKenzie, for Mr. Reed to comment. Regarding the waivers, I think it's important to understand that, you know, observers' cars break down or things go awry, and so that's intended to provide some flexibility for the service to allow a trip to leave the dock should things beyond expectation go awry. I want to build in some flexibility that allows those contingencies to be dealt with. I can't speak to this motion because it's Mr. Reed's motion to amend, but my underlying motion has the default coverage at year 4 and 5 would be, I mean, my question about that would be back to the service, and that is, what is the minimum coverage that the service feels is needed to maintain data credibility? So I think pulling a number of the hat right now is a bit awkward for me, and I'm not comfortable doing that. So I think for the lack of a better position, I'm going to leave that issue unaddressed and defer to the PDT analyses, either past or future, to define what that base minimum is, base coverage rate is based upon the need to effectively manage this fishery.
Just to clear my screen, could Dr. Sissonwine and Attorney McDonald take their hands down so I'm not recalling on you? All right. Okay, now Ms. Griffin and then Mr. Balzano, and then I'm going to go out to the audience for comments on the motion to amend. Ms. Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I was just muted there for a minute. So I have two questions, trying to separate them out from my comments. First, to Ms. Ware's questions about the longer time period, that 4 years seems to make sense to me in terms of setting a solid baseline review, because my question is, operationally, is it feasible to ramp up immediately from where we are to 100%, given, you know, what we just did in this last year, ramping up, I think, by 10%. So, you know, while we're saying 100%, is that actually going, I just want to understand what's really realistic here in the first year. So, you know, there may be some benefit in a way if that's not achieved in year one in terms of stretching out the funds, but the earlier years won't contribute as much to the valuation. So my first question, I guess, is for both the agency and for the Science Center about what they think is operationally feasible in terms of achieving 100% right away, because that feeds back into this intending to be an evaluation. And then my second question gets to what people have been discussing with the default. And so I read this motion as implicitly containing a different section in our amendment. That section, I think it's 4.4.2.1, which is about, you know, whatever the council sets as a target, higher monitoring coverage levels up to 100% could be achieved if NIMS funds are available. So I'm wondering, to the maker and the seconder, perhaps maybe making that more explicit will help with clarifying the intent that I hear you saying right now is to set that default at NEFOP, which, you know, makes me pause. And I think I'd like to hear some more discussion about whether that's an appropriate default or not. But those are my questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Does the maker or the seconder want to respond to any of Ms. Griffin's questions?
I can respond to that if you don't mind.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Melanie that additional section should be referenced because it is pulled into this whole thing. I mean, Dr. McKenzie made the original motion, so it's really up to him. I'm only amending his motion. As far as the base at NEFOP, I mean, that's something that, in my mind, is a default. If there's money available for any coverage over that, then that's another thing, and it can be applied. It's stated plainly in the original motion and the amended motion that the coverage selected is a target coverage rate. You know, there's been some discussion about where additional funds can come from. You know, my amendment is one source of funding that actually is already considered in this whole thing. But, you know, I'm looking at, I don't know how many letters from congressmen and mayors and governors. They want to protect the industry. Well, they can help figure it out. And, you know, instead of getting hundreds or thousands of letters, that pressure can be applied instead of to the industry, can be applied to Congress to make this thing work. So we can redirect some effort there as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yep, yes, you may, Doctor.
Thank you. I agree with Eric on that, on his agreement with Melanie's positions. Regarding the base level coverage that a lot of people have asked about for year four, I think I'm okay with year four base level being anywhere from NEFOP up to 100%. I think that will work, but my preference would be clearly to defer to the DEIS, which says a minimum amount needed to ensure the credibility of the data stream is 75%. But I understand that there's a whole lot of things in play here, and in year four, who knows where we're going to be. So my intent would be year four base coverage to be anywhere between NEFOP rates and 100%.
Okay, next up, Mr. Balzano, then Mr. Gates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I start, I know we're not supposed to advocate this part of the thing, but I really like the way the motion to amend is going, and I appreciate a lot of the interpretations by the regional administrator, general counsel, and members of the council itself. Problem I'm having with it, and it's been addressed by some of the other questions from Mr. Alexander, Dr. Fissenwine, and Ms. Griffin, is there's a huge difference between what is said and what is interpreted. And I have a two-part question. One has to do with funding, and then the other part has to do with feasibility of implementation. Can I ask it in two parts, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, and then I think we're getting into almost debating this now. So we've got a pending motion to amend, which I'm going to call on the people that have got their hands up if there's questions. But if we're going to have a debate, I'd rather go up to the audience first to speak to the pending motion and then come back. And then if people want to offer further amendments to the motion to amend or clarifying language, but I want to make sure that happens. So yes, you may, Mr. Balzano. That's my long answer.
I understand. So my first question is this. You look at the last sentence. Industry funding rates are subject to availability of agency funding and congressional appropriations. My interpretation of this is 100% sticks, but the 0-4 ASM and the 0-4 EM goes away because the funding is not available. Now, that's not how the intent of the maker of the motion and the seconder, and it was not the interpretation of the regional administrator, but that's still what this motion says. So I'm not a wordsmither, but if we could get somebody to better clarify in this motion what the intent is, that's my first question.
Dr. McKenzie or Mr. Reed, any response to Mr. Balzano's question for clarifying text?
All right, I'll bite. I don't have any clarifying text. The intent of the motion has been well stated over the last several minutes or however long it's been, and the administrative record will show that intent, and to me that's enough. My intent is to have the industry pay for nothing.
Second question, Mr. Balzano.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My second question is to staff is, what has been our realized coverage rate versus our target, say over the last couple of years? It just a quick, simple, have we ever met our target in coverage rates?
Dr. Cornane.
Yeah. Pardon me. I'll refer folks to page 233 of the draft amendment for folks to take a peek at that. I don't want to interrupt the public comment discussion.
And so we'll get that to you.
Thank you. And then the last part is what Ms. Griffin had talked about was feasibility. do we have the observers to be able to fulfill 100%? Or do we have the technology and the equipment to fulfill everybody that wants to be in the EM program?
So I think that would be a Dr. Hare question if you wanted to, or a Mike Pentney question. Dr. Hare.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in terms of the question about the availability of at-sea monitors, one of the waiver conditions that we've had in this, in our all of our fisheries, is if an observer is not available, a waiver can be granted. Also, I think it's not quite clear to me what year one is, but if we're talking May 2022, then that would be a substantial amount of time to train observers and have the observer service providers bring the number of observers up to support this. In terms of equipment available, that's a harder question to answer. I think, the EM programs that are running now have not been limited by the equipment. My understanding is that, they've been limited in part by participants. So I don't think EM equipment is going to be a barrier here.
Okay, here's what I'm gonna do, because we're getting a little far afield on what we're having a debate here without the public commenting on the motion to amend, which is pending. I know that motion to amend was made immediately, so we really didn't have discussion on the main motion. But so I got a couple more hands here. Melanie Griffin, I see your hand up. I think it's left up. If you could take that down, unless you had another question. And I've got Matt Gates, Attorney Etri, and then I'm going to call on Mitch McDonald, and that then out to the audience on the motion to amend. So Gates, Etri, McDonald.
Thank you for this opportunity to comment on this. The year one through four, and then year four, and then year five part at the bottom. I get what we're trying to do is have 100% coverage and not have the industry pay anything for it. I feel like this wording at the bottom sort of muddles that, particularly the year four funding will serve as a default coverage and funding until a new council action is completed. So what that tells me is that if we have 100% coverage in year four, but no funding left, I'm not sure how we would do what it says there. It seems different than what we've been discussing. I thought it would be clearer if we just said we would have 100% coverage of all trips, industry funding for EM, equipment review costs at 0%, and ASM at 0%. Until adjusted coverage levels in a follow-on action, and get rid of the last two sentences, the last two things there. It just seems like that would be more clear as to what we're trying to do here.
Okay. All right, Attorney Etri.
I'm slightly channeling the Princess Bride and getting to the point where I want to say you keep using a word, but I don't think you think it means what you think it means. I have now gotten slightly confused about what the motion to amend is and is not saying, because we have a situation where someone is clarifying something, the maker of the motion is clarifying, the seconder of the motion is clarifying, but they're clarifying different things. And then I think it was Scott just made a recommendation to clarify your four and five, which may make sense. I'm just gonna throw it out there. It's a little bit weird because we're all remote, but could we maybe take a pause and see if we can kind of clean this up so that both us as a council understand what the motions are saying and the public understands what they're saying before we go out for a public comment on them? I'm just throwing it out there. Thank you.
All right, I was muted. So I'm gonna call on Attorney McDonald, then Mr. Neese, and then go out to the audience for some general comment, understanding that there may be some cleanup needed, but I think the sense of the motion to amend is there. I don't wanna continue on as if we're having a debate at the council without letting the public be heard on this. So Attorney McDonald, Mr. Neese, and then out to the audience. Attorney McDonald put his hand down.
Oh, I did. I did because I thought you would want me to.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm going to ask you to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You all set? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the I just wanted to harken back to one of my earlier concerns and make sure that I understand this, and maybe this is something for if it's going to be cleaned up a little bit. The motion would be, but when this motion is talking about industry funding being available, I have been presuming that that means, I'm sorry, that government funding is available for the industry costs. That means it's under a similar construct as now. Dr. Hare has been talking about, you know, the available money that's been left over from fiscal years 18, 19, and 20, and that that's subject to these grant mechanisms being sort of carrying forward, and this reimbursement model being used. So I wanted to just sort of clarify that and make sure of that, and as well as sort of remind folks that that's, you know, got to go through the review process.
The maker of the motion or the seconder care to respond to that? All right, hearing none, I'm going to call on Mr. Neese.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to reiterate just a couple things that have been mentioned by a couple council members. I guess I'm a little nervous that the motion does not really describe what the intent of the maker and the seconder are. And in some cases, I think there appears to be differences between what the maker said his intent is and what the seconder said the intent is. There's been a lot of discussion about what happens in year four if there's not federal funding available, but it's a little unclear about what happens in year one to four if there's not available funding available. And related to Mr. Balzano's comment, it does seem like there's some language in the motion that is potentially internally inconsistent with itself, where it talks about industry funding rates being subject to available agency funding and congressional appropriations. So, you know, the reason I bring this up now, I know there's a concern, there was a suggestion that we can fix some of these things later, but I'm a little concerned that public comment that may be coming up may depend a little bit on how these things are addressed. The other thing is, you know, there's been some language suggested by people to be added to this motion, but in some cases there hasn't been a clear statement by anyone whether that language should be added or not. So when we come back, I think that would be helpful for Joan to make sure that we get those statements added. There's been a couple questions, and I just to put some things in context, Dr. Hare said that there was $12 million available basically today. That does not mean there will be $12 million available at the start of fishing year 2022. You know, you have a memo from me that gives some very crude estimates of how much money would be available, assuming we're going to spend money between now and then. And just to give an idea, you know, the money we have in hand is probably not enough to cover 4 years of 100% coverage, just to be clear on that. It obviously depends on what the costs are, how many people choose EM and everything else. But, you know, a crude, again, admittedly crude estimate is that the money we'll have available by the start of fishing year 22 is probably enough to cover about 1.5 to 2 years of this program. And I guess the final thing is, I think that words matter in motions. And as we all know, I just think that before we have a final vote on this motion, we need to make sure that the language of the motion says exactly what we mean so that it's not open to misinterpretation after everything gets passed. The council votes on the language that's on the board. They don't vote on the intent and what an individual council member may say the intent of the motion is. And then one last procedural issue, I would ask that the public please not raise your hand until the chair asks for public comment. It confuses us with trying to keep track of who's asking when, and that it messes up our list. So please refrain from raising your hand until the chair asks for public comment. Thank you.
All right. That being said, both by the executive director and Ms. Etri, and I certainly don't want to put a unfinished motion to amend out to the audience and have them rely on something that gets changed in the smoothing out of the language. So what I'm going to propose, and I just can't resist going back to my original opening remarks, that we had a groundfish meeting yesterday, a few days ago. I only wish that this language had been brought forward then, so we could have had this discussion then, and there maybe could have been brought to the full council with a preferred alternative selection. You know, this is really having a groundfish committee meeting all over again, and that's not how the council designed, and it's unfortunate that the council process, the committee process, has not been used appropriately in getting these ideas in front of the full council. So with that, I'm going to charge Mr. Reed and Dr. McKenzie, the two makers of the motion, with convening during our break, clarifying the language, whatever we want to call it. I just want to ask Mr. Neese, is there a way to, is there a chat room or a breakout group on this GoToWebinar that they could have a virtual meeting for those that are interested?
We can set up a separate GoToMeeting thing. I'm a little nervous about doing that, but if, as long as everything, you know, I would turn to Mitch, as long as everything comes back to the council, we could probably do that. It would take me a minute or two, and I would need to know the council members who want to participate in it.
Or could we just do it on this platform, and you could people could log back in?
Well, give me a minute to think. I'm actually not sure setting up a separate meeting is a good idea, because people would probably have to sign out of one and back into the other, and that could cause problems. I think a better thing might be is if they talk and then come back and try and work it out here on this platform.
Okay.
We don't have a separate room feature like some programs do in order to do that.
Okay. All right. So why don't we break until 1:30? Those want to participate in the wordsmithing and getting more meat on the motion to amend, can talk separately, then come back to. I'm happy to be the convener, but I don't know who wants to talk to who about what. So,
Mr. Chair, staff reminded me that we can set up a call-in only number and circulate it to all the council members, and set it, let's say, a starting time of 12:30, which gives everybody a little bit of a break, and then they could discuss it on that GoToMeeting. But anything that would be discussed in that GoToMeeting would have to be brought forward in public during the council meeting.
Yes. Yeah. All right. That sounds like a plan. Then we'll do that. And anything discussed, obviously, is will be brought to the full council and be discussed in public. But just to try and wordsmith some of this. So with that, we will stand in recess till 1:30. We will be sent a call-in number to convene at 12:30, those are interested. So stand in recess till 1:30.